Track 7.
Sally Ann slid up along the bench and gave them a few inches of space, and Samantha perched in Nicholas's lap. The wine was a rough fighting red, and it galloped, booted, and spurred across his palate. But Samantha sipped her share with the same relish as if it had been a 53 Chateau Lafitte, and she nuzzled Nicholas's ear and whispered, "Tom is prof of the biology department. He's a honey. After you, he's my most favorite man in the world." A woman came through from the galley, carrying a huge platter piled high with bright pink shrimps and a bowl of molten butter. There was a roar of applause for her as she placed the dishes in the center of the table, and they fell upon the food with unashamed gusto. The woman was tall, with dark hair in braids, and a strong, capable face, lean and supple in tight breeches. But she was older than the other women, and she paused beside Tom Parker and draped one arm across his shoulders in a comfortable gesture of long-established affection. "That's Antoinette, his wife." The woman heard her name and smiled across at them, and with dark, gentle eyes, she studied Nicholas and then nodded and made the continental O of thumb and forefinger at Samantha before slipping back into the galley. The food did not inhibit the talk, a lively, contentious flow of discussion that swung swiftly from banter to deadly seriousness and back again. Bright, trained, informed minds clicking and cannoning off each other with the crispness of ivory billiard balls, while at the same time buttery fingers ripped the whiskered heads off the shrimps, delving for the crescent of sweet white flesh, then leaving greasy fingerprints on the wine tumblers. As each of them spoke, Samantha whispered their names and credentials. "Hank Peterson, he's doing a PhD on the bluefin tuna, spawning and a trace of its migratory roots. He's the one running the tagging tomorrow. That's Michelle Rand. She's on loan from UCLA, and she's porpoises and whales." Then suddenly, they were all discussing indignantly a rogue tanker captain who the week before had scrubbed his tanks in the middle of the Florida Straits and left a 30-mile slick down the Gulf Stream. He had done it under cover of night, and changed course as soon as he was into the Atlantic proper. "We fingerprinted him, Tom Parker, like an angry bear. We had him made, dead in the crosshairs." Nick knew he was talking of the fingerprinting of oil residues, the breakdown of samples of the slick under gas spectroscopy, which could match them exactly to the samples taken by the Coast Guard from the offender's tanks. The identification was good enough to bear up in an international court of law. "But the trick is getting the son of a bitch into court," Tom Parker went on. "He was 50 miles outside our territorial waters by the time the Coast Guard got to him, and he's registered in Liberia. We tried to cover cases like that in a set of proposals I put up to the last maritime conference." Nick joined the conversation for the first time. He told them of the difficulties of legislating on an international scale, of policing and bringing to justice the blatant transgressors. Then he listed for them what had been done so far, what was in process, and finally what he believed still should be done to protect the seas. He spoke quietly, succinctly, and Samantha noticed again, with a swell of pride, how all men listened when Nicholas Berg talked. The moment he paused, they came at him from every direction, using their bright young minds like scalpels, tearing into him with sharp, lancing questions. He answered them in the same fashion, sharp and hard, armed with the total knowledge of his subject, and he saw the shift in the group attitude, the blooming of respect, the subtle opening of ranks to admit him. For he had spoken the correct passwords, and they recognized him as one of their own number, as one of the elite. At the head of the table, Tom Parker sat and listened, nodding and frowning, sitting in judgment with his arm around Antoinette's slim waist, and she stood beside him and played idly with a curl of thick, wiry hair on the top of his head. Tom Parker found fish 40 miles offshore, where the Gulf Stream was setting blue and warm and fast into the north. The birds were working, falling on folded wings down the backdrop of cumulonimbus storm clouds that bruised the horizon. The birds were bright, white pinpoints of light as they fell, and they struck the dark blue water with tiny explosions of white spray and went deep. Seconds later, they popped to the surface, stretching their necks to force down another morsel into their distended crops, before launching into flight again, climbing in steep circles against the sky to join the hunt again. There were hundreds of them, and they swelled and fell like snowflakes. "Anchovy," grunted Tom Parker, and they could see the agitated surface of the water under the bird flock, where the frenzied baitfish churned. Could be Bonito working under them. "No," said Nick. "They're blues." "You sure?" Tom grinned a challenge. "The way they're bunching and holding the baitfish, it's tuna," Nick repeated. "$5? Tom asked as he swung the wheel over, and Tricky Dicky's big diesel engine boomed as she went on to the top of her speed. "You're on." Nick grinned back at him. At that moment, they both saw a fish jump clear. It was a brilliant, shimmering torpedo, as long as a man's arm. It went 6 feet into the air, turned in flight, and hit the water again with a smack they heard clearly above the diesel. "Blues," said Nick flatly. "Shoal blues. They'll go £20 each." $5, Tom grunted with disgust. "Son of a gun, I don't think I can afford you, man." And he delivered a playful punch to the shoulder, which rattled Nick's teeth. Then he turned to the open window of the wheelhouse and bellowed out onto the deck, "Okay, kids, they are blues." There was a scramble and chatter of excitement as they rushed for the lines and tagging poles. It was Hank's show. He was the bluefin tunny expert. He knew as much about their sex habits, their migratory routes and food chains as any man living. But when it came to catching them, Nick observed dryly, he could probably do a better job as a blacksmith. Tom Parker was no fisherman either. He ran down the shoal, charging Tricky Dicky through the center of it, scattering birds and fish in panic. But by sheer chance, one of the gang in the stern hooked in, and after a great deal of heaving and huffing and shouted encouragement from his peers, dragged a single luckless baby bluefin tuna over the rail. It skittered and jumped around the deck, its tail hammering against the planking, pursued by a shrieking band of scientists who slid and slipped in the fish slime, knocked each other down, and finally cordoned the fish against the rail. The first three attempts to affix the plastic tag were unsuccessful, Hank's lunges with the dart pole becoming wilder as his frustration mounted. He almost succeeded in tagging Samantha's raised backside as she knelt on the deck, trying to cradle the fish in both arms. "You do this often?" Nicholas asked mildly. "First time with this gang," Tom Parker admitted sheepishly. "Thought you'd never guess." By now, the triumphant band were solicitously returning the fish to the sea. The barbed dart of the plastic tag embedded dangerously near its vitals, and if that didn't eventually kill it, the rough handling probably would. It had pounded its head on the deck so heavily that blood oozed from the gill covers. It floated away, belly up on the stream, oblivious of Samantha's anguished cries of, "Swim, fish! Get in there and swim!" "Mind if we try it my way?" Nick asked, and Tom relinquished command without a struggle. Nicholas picked the four strongest and best coordinated of the young men and gave them a quick demonstration and lecture on how to handle the heavy handlines with the Japanese feather lures, showing them how to throw the bait and the recovery with an underhand flick that recoiled the line between the feet. Then he gave each a station along the starboard rail, with the second member of each team ready with a tagging pole, and Hank Peterson on the roof of the wheelhouse to record the fish taken and the numbers of the tags. They found another shoal within the hour, and Nicholas circled up on it, closing steadily at good trolling speed, helping the feeding tuna bunch the shoal of frenzied anchovy onto the surface, until he could lock Tricky Dicky's wheel hard down starboard and leave her to describe her own sedate circles around the shoal. Then he hurried out onto the deck. The trapped and surrounded fish thrashed the surface until it boiled like a porridge of molten flashing silver. Through it drove the fast dark torpedoes of the hungry tuna. Within minutes, Nick had his four fishermen working to the steady rhythm of throwing the lures into the frothing water, almost instantly striking back on the line as a tuna snatched the feathers, and then swinging hand over head, recovering and coiling the line fast with minimum effort, swinging the fish out and up with both hands, and then catching its streamlined body under the left armpit like a quarterback picking up a long pass, clamping it there firmly, although the cold, firm silver bullet shape juddered and quivered and the tail beat in a blur of movement. Then he caught them to slip the hook from the jaw, careful not to damage the vulnerable gills, holding the fish firmly but gently, while the assistant pressed the barbed dart into the thick muscle at the back of the dorsal fin. When the fish was dropped back over the side, there were so few after effects that it almost immediately began feeding again on the packed masses of tiny anchovies. Each plastic tag was numbered and imprinted with a request in five languages to mail it back to University of Miami with details of date and place of capture, providing a valuable trace on the movements of the shoals of their annual circumnavigation of the globe. From their spawning grounds somewhere in the Caribbean, they worked the Gulf Stream north and east across the Atlantic, then south, down, and around the Cape of Good Hope, with an occasional foray down the length of the Mediterranean Sea. Although now the dangerous pollution of that landlocked water was changing their habits. From Good Hope east again, south of Australia, to take a gigantic swing up and around the Pacific, running the gauntlet of the Japanese longliners and the Californian tunny men, before ducking down under the terrible icy seas of the Horn and back to their spawning grounds in the Caribbean. They sat up on the wheelhouse as the dicky ran home in the sunset, drinking beer and talking. Nicholas studied them casually and saw that they possessed so many of the qualities he valued in his fellow humans. They were intelligent and motivated. They were dedicated and free of that particular avarice that mars so many others. Tom Parker crumpled the empty beer can in a huge fist, as easily as if it had been a paper basket, fished two more from the pack beside him, and tossed one across to Nick. The gesture seemed to have some special significance, and Nicholas saluted him with the can before he drank. Samantha was snuggled down in luxurious weariness against his shoulder, and the sunset was a magnificence of purple and hot molten crimson. Nicholas thought idly how pleasant it would be to spend the rest of his life doing things like this with people like these. Tom Parker's office had shelves to the ceiling, and they were sagging with hundreds of bottled specimens and rows of scientific papers and publications. He sat well back in his swivel chair, with ankles crossed neatly in the centre of the cluttered desk. I ran a check on you, Nicholas. Damn nerve, wasn't it? You have my apology. Was it an interesting exercise? Nicholas asked mildly. It wasn't difficult. You have left a trail behind you like a... Tom sought for a comparison. Like a grizzly bear through a honey farm. Son of a gun, Nicholas. That's a hell of a track record you've got yourself. I've kept busy, Nicholas admitted. Beer? Tom crossed to the refrigerator in the corner that was labeled Zoological Specimens Do Not Open. It's too early for me. Never too early, said Tom, and pulled the tag on a dewy can of Miller's, and then picked up Nicholas's statement. Yes, you have kept busy. Strange, isn't it, that around some men things just happen? Nicholas did not reply, and Tom went on. We need a man around here who can do. It's all right thinking out. Then you need the catalyst to transform thought and intention into action. Tom sucked at the can and then licked the froth of his moustache. I know what you have done. I've heard you speak. I've seen you move, and those things count. But most important of all, I know you care. I've been watching you carefully, Nick. And you really care, down deep in your guts, the way we do. It sounds as though you were offering me a job, Tom. I'm not going to horse around, Nick. I am offering you a job. He waved a huge paw, like a bunch of broiled pork sausages. Hell, I know you're a busy man. But I'd like to romance you into an associate professorship. We'd want a little of your time, and when it came to hassling and negotiating up in Washington, we'd call for you when we needed real muscle to put our case. When we need the right contacts, somebody with a big reputation to open doors. When we need a man who knows the practical side of the oceans and the men that use them and abuse them. We need a man who is a hard-headed businessman, who knows the economics of sea trade, who has built and run tankers, who knows that human need is of paramount importance, but who can balance the human need for protein and fossil fuels against the greater danger of turning the oceans into watery deserts. Tom lubricated his throat with beer, watching shrewdly for some reaction from Nicholas. And when he received no encouragement, he went on more persuasively. We are specialists. Perhaps we have the specialists' narrow view. God knows, they think of us as sentimentalists, the lunatic fringe of the doomsayers, long-haired intellectual hippies. What we need is a man with real clout in the establishment. Ah, shit, Nicholas. If you walked into a congressional committee, they'd really jerk out of their geriatric trance and switch on their hearing aids. Nicholas was silent still, and Tom was becoming desperate. What can we offer in return? I know you aren't short of cash, and it would be a lousy $12,000 a year, but an associate professorship is a nice title. We start out holding hands with that. Then we might start going steadier, a full professorship, chair of applied oceanology, or some juicy title like that which we'd think up. I don't know what else we can offer you, Nick, except perhaps the warm, good feeling in your guts that you're doing a tough job that has to be done. He stopped again, running out of words, and he wagged his big, shaggy head sadly. You aren't interested, are you? He asked. Nick stirred himself. When do I start? He asked. And as Tom's face split into a great beaming grin, Nick held out his hand. I think I'll take that beer now. The water was cool enough to be invigorating. Nick and Samantha swam so far out that the land was almost lost in the lowering gloom of dusk. And then they turned and swam back side by side. The beach was deserted. In their mood, the lights of the nearest condominiums were no more intrusive than the stars, the faint sound of music and laughter no more intrusive than the cry of gulls. It was the right time to tell her, and he did it in detail, beginning with the offer by the sheikhs to buy out ocean salvage and towage. "Will you sell?" she asked quietly. "You won't, will you?" "For $7 million clear?" he asked. "Do you know how much money that is?" "I can't count that far," she admitted. "But what would you do if you sold? I can't imagine you playing bowls or golf for the rest of your life." "A part of the deal is that I run Ocean Salvage for them for 2 years, and then I've been offered a part-time assignment which will fill any spare time I've got left over." "What is it?" "Associate professor at Miami University." She stopped dead and dragged him around to face her. "You're having me on," she accused. "That's a start only," he admitted. "In 2 years or so, when I finish with Ocean Salvage, there may be a full chair of applied oceanology." "It's not true," she said, and took him by the arms, shaking him with surprising strength. "Tom wants me to ramrod the applied aspects of the environmental research. I'll troubleshoot with legislators and the Maritime Conference a sort of hired gun for the green pieces." "Oh, Nicholas, Nicholas. Oh, sweet Christ," he accused. "You're crying again." "I just can't help it." She was in his arms, still wet and cold and gritty with beach sand. She clung to him, quivering with joy. "Do you know what this means, Nicholas?" "You don't, do you? You just don't realize what this means."
"Tell me," he invited. "What does it mean?"
"What it means is that in future, we can do everything together. Not just munch food and go boom in bed, but everything. Work and play and live together, like a man and a woman should."
She sounded stunned and frightened by the magnitude of the vision.
"The prospect daunts me not at all," he murmured gently and lifted her chin. They washed off the salt and the sand, crowding together into the thick, perfumed steam of the shower cubicle. And afterwards, they lay together on the patchwork quilt in the darkness, with the sound of the sea as background music to the plans and dreams they wove together. Every time they both descended to the very frontiers of sleep, one of them would think of something vitally important and prod the other awake to say it. "I've got to be in London on Tuesday."
"I don't spoil it all now," she murmured sleepily.
"And then we're launching Sea Witch on the 7th of April."
"I'm not listening," she whispered. "I've got my fingers in my ears."
"Will you launch her? I mean, break the bottle of bubbly and bless her."
"I've just taken my fingers out again."
"Jules would love it."
"Nicholas, I cannot spend my life commuting across the Atlantic, not even for you. I've got work to do."
"Peter will be there. I'll work that as a bribe."
"That's unfair pressure," she protested.
"Will you come?"
"You know I will, you sexy bastard. I wouldn't miss it for all the world."
She moved across the quilt and found his ear with her lips. "I am honored."
"Both of you are sea witches," Nick told her. "And you are my warlock."
"Sea witch and warlock," he chuckled. "Together, we will work miracles."
"Look, I know it's terribly forward of me, but seeing that we are both wide awake, and it's only 2 o'clock in the morning, I'd be super ultra grateful if you could work one of your little miracles for me right now."
"It will be a great pleasure," Nick told her.
Nicholas was early. He saw as he came out of the American consulate and glanced at his Rolex. So he moderated his pace across the Place de la Concorde, despite the gentle, misty rain that settled in minute droplets on the shoulders of his trench coat. Lazarus was at the rendezvous ahead of him, standing under one of the statues in the corner of the square, closest to the French naval headquarters. It was a heavily muffled figure against the cold, dressed all in somber blue, with a long cashmere scarf wound around his throat, and a dark blue hat pulled down so low as to conceal the pale, smooth bulge of his forehead.
"Let's find a warm place," Nick suggested, without greeting the little man.
"No," said Lazarus, looking up at him through the thick, distorting lenses of his spectacles. "Let us walk." And he led the way through the underpass onto the promenade above the embankment of the Seine, and set off in the direction of the Petit Palais. In the middle of such an inclement afternoon, they were the only strollers. They walked in silence 300 or 400 yards, while Lazarus satisfied himself absolutely of this, and while he adjusted his mincing little steps to Nick's stride. It was like taking Toulouse-Lautrec for a stroll. Nick smiled to himself. Even when Lazarus began speaking, he kept glancing back over his shoulder. And once, when two bearded Algerian students in combat jackets overtook them, he let them get well ahead before he went on. "You know, there'll be nothing in writing," he piped.
"I have a recorder in my pocket," Nick assured him.
"Very well. You are entitled to that."
"Thank you," murmured Nick dryly.
Lazarus paused. It was almost as though a new reel was being fitted into the computer. And when he began talking again, his voice had a different timbre, a monotonous, almost electronic tone, as though he was indeed an automaton. First, there was a recital of share movements in the 33 companies which made up the Christie Marine Complex. Every movement in the previous 18 months. The little man reeled them off steadily, as though he were actually reading from the share registers of the companies. He must have had access, Nicholas realized, to achieve such accuracy. He had the date, the number of shares, the transferer and transferee, even the transfer of shares in Ocean Salvage and Towage to Nicholas himself, and the reciprocal transfer of Christie Marine stock was faithfully detailed, confirming the accuracy of Lazarus's other information. It was all an impressive exhibition of total knowledge and total recall, but much too complicated for Nicholas to make any sense of it. He would have to study it carefully. All that he would hazard was that somebody was putting up a smoke screen. Lazarus stopped on the corner of the Champs-Élysées and the Rue de la Boétie. Nicholas glanced down at him and saw his shapeless blob of a nose was an unhealthy purplish pink in the cold, and that his breathing had coarsened and labored with the exertion of walking. Nick realized suddenly that the little man was probably asthmatic, and as if to confirm this, he took a little silver and turquoise pill box from his pocket and slipped a single pink capsule into his mouth
before leading Nicholas into the foyer of a movie house and buying two tickets. It was a porno movie, a French version of Deep Throat, entitled Gorge Profonde. The print was scratched, and the French dubbing was out of synchronization. The cinema was almost empty, so they found two seats in isolation at the rear of the stalls. Lazarus stared unblinkingly at the screen as he began the second part of his report. This was a detailed breakdown of cash movements within the Christie Marine group, and Nick was again amazed at the man's penetration. He drew a verbal picture of the assemblage of enormous sums of money, marshalled and channeled into orderly flows by a master tactician. The genius of Duncan Alexander was as clearly identifiable as that flourishing signature with the flamboyant A and X, which Nicholas had seen him dash off with studied panache. Then, suddenly, the cash flow was not so steady and untroubled. There were eddies and breaks, little gaps and inconsistencies that nagged at Nicholas like the false chimes of a broken clock. Lazarus finished this section of his report with a brief summation of the group's cash and credit position as at a date 4 days previously. And Nicholas realized that the doubts were justified. Duncan had run the group out along a knife edge. Nicholas sat hunched down in the threadbare velvet seat, both hands thrust into the pockets of his trench coat, watching the incredible feats of Miss Lovelace on the screen, without really seeing them, while beside him, Lazarus took an aerosol can from his pocket, screwed a nozzle onto it, and noisily sprayed a fine mist down his own throat. It seemed to relieve him almost immediately. Insurance and marine underwriting of vessels owned by the Christie Marine Group of Companies. He began again with names and figures and dates, and Nicholas picked up the trend. Duncan was using his own captive company, London and European Insurance and Banking, to lead the risk on all his vessels, and then he was reinsuring in the marketplace, spreading part of the risk, but carrying a whacking deductible himself, the principle of self-insurance that Nicholas had opposed so vigorously, and which had rebounded so seriously upon Duncan's head with the salvage of Golden Adventurer. The last of the vessels in Lazarus's recital was Golden Dawn, and Nicholas shifted restlessly in his seat at the mention of the name, and almost immediately he realized that something strange was taking place. Christie Marine did not apply for a Lloyd's survey of this vessel. Nicholas knew that already. But she has been rated first class by the Continental Surveyors. It was a much easier rating to obtain, and consequently less acceptable than the prestigious A1 at Lloyd's. Lazarus went on, lowering his voice slightly, as another patron entered the almost deserted cinema and took a seat two rows in front of them. And insurance has been effected outside Lloyd's. The risk was led by London and European Insurance. Again, Duncan was self-insuring, Nicholas noted grimly, but not all of it. And further lines were written by... Lazarus listed the other companies which carried a part of the risk, with whom Duncan had reinsured. But it was all too thin, too nebulous. Again, only careful study of the figures would enable Nicholas to analyze what Duncan was doing, how much was real insurance, and how much was bluff to convince his financiers that the risk was truly covered, and their investment protected. Some of the names of the reinsurers were familiar. They had been on the list of transferees who had taken stock positions in Christie Marine.
Is Duncan buying insurance with capital? Nicholas pondered. Was he buying at desperate prices? He must have cover, of course. Without insurance, the finance houses, the banks and institutions which had loaned money to Christie Marine to build the monstrous tanker would dig in against Duncan. His own shareholders would raise such hell. No. Duncan Alexander had to have cover, even if it was paper only, without substance, a mere incestuous circle, a snake eating itself tail first. Oh, but the trail was so cleverly confused, so carefully swept and tied up. Only Nicholas's intimate knowledge of Christie Marine made him suspicious. It might take a team of investigators years to unravel the tortured tapestry of deceit. In the first instant, it had occurred to Nicholas that the easiest way to stop Duncan Alexander was to leak his freshly gleaned suspicions to Duncan's major creditors, to those who had financed the building of Golden Dawn. But immediately, he realized that this was not enough. There were no hard facts. It was all inference and innuendo. By the time the facts could be exhumed and laid out in all their putrefaction for autopsy, Golden Dawn would be on the high seas, carrying a million tons of crude. Duncan might have won sufficient time to make his profit and sell out to some completely uncontrollable Greek or Chinaman, as he had boasted he would do. It would not be so simple to stop Duncan Alexander. It was folly to have believed that for one moment. Even if his creditors were made aware of the flimsy insurance cover over Golden Dawn, were they too deeply in already? Would they not then accept the risks, spreading them where they could, and simply twist the financial rope a little tighter around Duncan's throat? No. It was not the way to stop him. Duncan had to be forced to remodify the giant tanker's hull, forced to make her an acceptable moral risk, forced to accept the standard Nicholas had originally stipulated for the vessel. Lazarus had finished the insurance portion of his report, and he stood up abruptly, just as Miss Lovelace was about to attempt the impossible. With relief, Nick followed him down the aisle and into the chill of a Parisian evening, and they breathed the fumes and the teeming city exhaled as Lazarus led him back eastwards through the 8th arrondissement with those little dancing steps, while he recited the details of the charters of all Christie Marine's vessels. The charterer, the rates, the dates of expiry of contract. And Nicholas recognized most of them. Contracts that he himself had negotiated, or those that had been renewed on expiry with minor alterations to the terms. He was relying on the recorder in his pocket, listening only with the surface layer of his mind, pondering all he'd heard so far from this extraordinary little man. So that when it came, he almost did not realize what he was hearing. On the 10th of January, Christie Marine entered a contract of carriage with Orient Amax. The tenure is 10 years. The vessel is to be employed is the Golden Dawn. The rate is 10 cents U.S. per 100 ton-miles... with a minimum annual guaranteed usage of 75,000 nautical miles. Nicholas registered the trigger word, Golden Dawn, and then he assimilated it all. The price, 10 cents per 100 ton-miles. That was wrong, high, much too high, ridiculously high in this depressed market.
then the name. Orient Amex.
Well, what was there about it that jarred his memory?
He stopped dead, and a following pedestrian bumped him. Nicholas shouldered him aside thoughtlessly and stood thinking, ransacking his mind for buried items of information. Lazarus had stopped also, and was waiting patiently. And now Nicholas laid a hand on the little man's shoulder.
I need a drink.
He drew him into a brasserie, which was thick with steam from the coffee machine, and the smoke of Caporal and Disque Bleu, and sat him at a tiny table by the window overlooking the sidewalk. Primly, Lazarus asked for a vitel water and sipped it with an air of virtue, while Nicholas poured soda into his whiskey.
Orient Amex, Nicholas asked as soon as the waiter had left. Tell me about it.
That is outside my original terms of reference, Lazarus demurred delicately.
Charge me for it, Nicholas invited.
And Lazarus paused as the computer reels clicked in his mind. Then he began to speak.
Orient Amex is an American-registered company with an issued capital of 25 million shares at a par value of $10.
Lazarus recited the dry statistics.
The company is presently undertaking substantial dry land exploration in Western Australia and Ethiopia, and offshore exploration within the territorial waters of Norway and Chile. It has erected a refinery at Galveston in Texas to operate under the new atomic catalyst cracking process, first employed at its pilot plant on the same site. The plant is projected for initial operation in June this year, and full production in 5 years. It was all vaguely familiar to Nicholas. The names, the process of cracking the low-value, high-carbon molecules, breaking up the carbon atoms, and reassembling them in volatile, low-carbon molecules of high value. The company operates producing wells in Texas and in the Santa Barbara offshore field in southern Nigeria, and has proven crude reserves in the El Baras field of Kuwait, which will be utilized by the new cracking plant in Galveston.
Good God! Nicholas stared at him. The El Baras field, but it's cadmium contaminated. It's been condemned by...
The El Baras field is a high cadmium field, naturally enriched with the catalyst necessary for the new process.
What are the cadmium elements? Nicholas demanded.
The western area of the El Baras field has sampled at 2,000 parts per million, and the north and eastern anticline have sampled as high as 42,000 parts per million.
Lazarus recited the figures pedantically.
The American and Nigerian crudes will be blended with the El Baras crudes during the revolutionary cracking process. It is projected that the yield of low-carbon volatiles will be increased from 40% to 85% by this process, making it 5 to 8 times more profitable and extending the life of the world's known reserves of crude petroleum by between 10 and 15 years.
As he listened, Nicholas had a vivid mental image of the stylus in Samantha's laboratory, recording the death throes of a cadmium-poisoned clam. Lazarus was talking on dispassionately.
During the cracking process, the cadmium sulfide will be reduced to its pure metallic non-toxic form and will be a valuable byproduct, reducing the cost of refining.
Nicholas shook his head in disbelief, and he spoke aloud. Duncan is going to do it. Across two oceans, 1,000,000 tons at a time, in that vulnerable, jerry-built monster of his. Duncan is going to do what no other ship owner has ever dared to do. He's going to carry the cad-rich crudes of El Barras. From the balcony windows of his suite in the Ritz, Nicholas could look out across the Place Vendôme of the column in the centre of the square, with its spiral bas-relief made from the Russian and Austrian guns, and commemorating the little Corsican's feats of arms against those two nations. While he studied the column and waited for his connection, he did a quick calculation and realized that it would be 3 o'clock in the morning on the eastern seaboard of North America. At least he would find her at home. Then he smiled to himself. If she wasn't at home, he'd want to know the reason why. The telephone rang, and he picked it up without turning away from the window. There was a confused mumbling, and Nicholas asked, "Who is this?" "It's Sam Silver. What's the time? Who is it?" "Good God, it's 3 o'clock. What do you want?" "Tell the other guy to put his pants on and go home."
"Nicholas!"
There was a joyous squeal, followed immediately by a crash and clatter that made Nicholas wince and lift the receiver well away from his ear.
"Oh, damn it to hell! I've knocked the table over. Nicholas, are you there? Speak to me, for God's sake."
"I love you." "Say that again, please. Where are you?" "Paris. I love you."
"Oh."
Her tone drooped miserably. "You sound so close, I thought..." Then she rallied gamely. "I love you, too."
"How's himself?"
"On the dole."
"Who is she?"
"Dole is unemployment insurance. Welfare." He sought the American equivalent. "I mean he is temporarily unemployed."
"Great. Keep him that way.
Did I tell you I love you? I forget."
"Wake up. Shake yourself. I've got something to tell you."
"I'm awake. Well, almost, anyway."
"Samantha, what would happen if somebody dumped 1,000,000 tons of 40,000 parts concentration of cadmium sulfide and an emulsion of aromatic Arabian crude into the Gulf Stream, say 30 nautical miles off Key West?"
"That's a freaky question, Nicholas. For 3 in the morning, that's a bomber."
"What would happen?" he insisted.
"The crude would act as a transporting medium." She was struggling to project a scenario through her sleepiness. "It would spread out on a surface to a thickness of 1/4 inch or so, so you'd end up with a slick of a few thousand miles long and 400 or 500 wide, and it would keep going."
"What would be the results?"
"It would wipe out most of the marine life on the Bahamas and on the eastern seaboard of the States. No, correct that. It would wipe out all marine life. That includes the spawning grounds of the tuna, the freshwater eels and the sperm whale, and it would contaminate..." She was coming fully awake now, and a stirring of horror altered her tone.
"You're macabre, Nicholas.
What a sick thing to think about, especially at 3 in the morning.
"Human life?" he asked.
"Yes, there would be a heavy loss," she said. "As sulfide, it would be readily absorbed, and in that concentration, it would be poisonous on contact. Fishermen, vacationers, anybody who walked on a contaminated beach." She was truly beginning to realize the enormity of it. A large part of the population of the cities on the East Coast. "Nicholas, it could amount to hundreds of thousands of human beings. And if it was carried beyond America on the Gulf Stream,
the Newfoundland banks, Iceland, the North Sea. It would poison the cod fisheries. It would kill everything, man, fish, bird, and animal. Then the tail of the Gulf Stream twists around the British Isles and the North Continent of Europe. But why are you asking me this? What kind of crazy guessing game is this, Nicholas?
Christy Marine has signed a 10-year contract to carry 1 million tons loads of crude from the El Barras field on the South Arabian Gulf to the Orient Amex refinery in Galveston. The El Barras crude has a cadmium sulfide constituent of between 2,000 and 40,000 parts per million. Now, there was a trembling outrage in her voice as she whispered, 1 million tons. That's some sort of genocide, Nicholas. There's probably never been a more deadly cargo in the history of seafaring. In a few weeks' time, Golden Dawn will run down her ways at Saint-Nazaire, and when she does, the seas of catastrophe will be sown upon the oceans. Her route from the Arabian Gulf takes her around Good Hope, one of the most dangerous seas in the world, the home of the 100-year wave, Nicholas agreed. Then, across the southern Atlantic, and into the bottleneck of the Gulf Stream between Key West and Cuba, into the Devil's Triangle, the breeding ground of the hurricanes. You can't let them do it, Nicholas, she said quietly. You just have to stop them. It won't be easy, but I'll be working hard on it this side. There are a dozen tricks I'm going to try. But you have to take over on your side, he told her. Samantha, you get Tom Parker. Get him out of bed if necessary. He has to hit Washington with the news. Hit all the media, television, radio, and the press. A confrontation with Orient Amex. Challenge them to make a statement. Samantha picked up the line he was taking. We'll get the green pieces to pick at the Orient Amex refinery in Galveston, the one which will process the cadmium crudes. We'll have every environmental agency in the country at work. We'll raise a stink like that of 1 million corpses, she promised. Fine, he said. You do all that, but don't forget to get your chubby little backside across here for the launching of Sea Witch. Chubby obese or chubby nice? She demanded. Chubby beautiful, he grinned. And I'll have room service ready to send up the food in a front-end loader. Nicholas sat over the telephone for the rest of that day, having his meals brought up to the suite, while he worked systematically down the long list of names he'd drawn up with the help of the tape recording of Lazarus's report. The list began with all those who it seemed had loaned capital to Christy Marine for the construction of Golden Dawn, and then went on to those who had written lines of insurance on the hull and on the pollution cover for the tanker. Nicholas dared not be too specific in the summation he gave to each of them. He did not want to give Duncan Alexander an opportunity to throw out a smokescreen of libel actions against him. But in each case, Nicholas spoke to the top men, mostly men he knew well enough to use their Christian names. And he said just enough to show that he knew the exact amount of their involvement with Christy Marine, to suggest they re-examine the whole project, especially with regard to Golden Dawn's underwriting and to her contract of carriage with Orient Amex. In the quiet intervals between each telephone call, or while a name was tracked down by a secretary, Nicholas sat over the Place Vendôme and carefully re-examined himself and his reactions, his reasons for what he was doing. It is so very easy for a man to attribute to himself the most noble motives. The sea had given Nicholas a wonderful life. and had rewarded him in wealth, reputation, and achievement. Now it was time to repay part of that debt, to use some of that wealth to protect and guard the oceans, the way a prudent farmer cherishes his soil. It was a fine thought. But when he looked below its shining surface, he saw the shape and movement of less savory creatures, like the shadows of shark and barracuda in the depths. There was pride. Golden Dawn had been his creation, the culmination of a lifetime's work. It was going to be the laurel crown on his career. But it had been taken from him and bastardized. And when it failed, when the whole marvelous concept collapsed in disaster and misery, Nicholas Berg's name would still be on it. The world would remember then that the whole grandiose design had originated with him. There was pride, and then there was hatred. Duncan Alexander had taken his woman and child. Duncan Alexander had wrested his very life from him. Duncan Alexander was the enemy. And by Nicholas's rules, he must be fought with the same single-mindedness, with the same ruthlessness, as he did everything in his life. Nicholas poured himself another cup of coffee and lit a cheroot. Brooding alone in the magnificence of his suite, he asked himself the question, if it had been another man in another ship who was going to transport the El Barras crews, would I have opposed him so bitterly? The question needed no formal reply. Duncan Alexander was the enemy. Nicholas picked up the telephone and placed the call he'd been delaying. He did not need to look in the red, calf-bound notebook for the number of the house in Eaton Square. "Mrs. Chantel Alexander, please." "I'm sorry, sir. Mrs. Alexander is at Cap Ferrat." "Of course," he muttered. "Thank you." "Do you want the number?" That's all right, I have it." He had lost track of time. He dialed again, this time down to the Mediterranean coast. "This is the residence of Mrs. Alexander, her son Peter Berg speaking." Nicholas felt the rush of emotion through his blood, so that it burned his cheeks and stung his eyes. "Hello, my boy." Even in his own ears, his voice sounded stilted, perhaps pompous. "Father!" Undisguised delight. "Dad, how are you, sir? Did you get my letters?" "No, I didn't. Where'd you send them?" "The flat in Queen's Gate." "I haven't been back there for," Nicholas thought, for nearly a month. "I got your cards, Dad, the one from Bermuda and the one from Florida. I just wrote to tell you..." And there was a recital of schoolboy triumphs and disasters. "That's tremendous, Peter. I'm really proud." Nicholas imagined the face of his son as he listened, and his heart was squeezed by guilt that he could do so little, could give him so little of his time, squeezed by longing for what he had lost. For it was only at times such as these that he could admit how much he missed his son. "That's great, Peter." The boy was trying to tell it all at the same time, gabbling out the news he had stored so carefully, flitting from subject to subject, as one thing reminded him of another. Then, of course, the inevitable question. "When can I come to you, Dad?" "I'll have to arrange that with your mother. But it'll be soon. I promised you that, Peter." "Let's get away from that," Nick thought desperately. "How is Apache? Have you raced her yet, these holidays?" "Oh, yes. Mother let me have a new set of Terraline sails in red and yellow. I raced her yesterday." Apache had not been actually placed first in the event, but Nicholas gained the impression that the blame lay not on her skipper, but rather on the vagaries of the wind, the unsporting behavior of the other competitors, who bumped when they had the weather gauge, and finally the starter, who had wanted to disqualify Apache for beating the gun. "But," Peter went on, "I'm racing again on Saturday morning." "Peter, where's your mother?" "She's down at the boat house." "Can you put this call through there? I must speak to her, Peter." "Of course." The disappointment in the child's voice was almost completely disguised. "Hey, Dad, you promised, didn't you? It will be soon." "I promised." "Cheerio, sir." There was a clicking and humming on the line, and then suddenly her voice, with its marvellous timbre and serenity. "C'est Chantal Alexandre qui parle. C'est Nicolas ici. Oh, my dear, how good to hear your voice. How are you? Are you alone?" "No, I have friends lunching with me. The Contessa is here with his new boyfriend, a matador, no less." The Contessa was an outrageously camp and wealthy homosexual who danced at Chantal's court. Nicholas could imagine the scene on the wide paved terrace, screened from the cliffs above by the sighing pines and the rococo pink boathouse with its turrets and rusty-coloured tiles. There would be gay and brilliant company under the colourful umbrellas. Pierre and Mimi sailed across from Cannes for the day. Pierre was the son of the largest manufacturer of civil and military jet aircraft in Europe, and Robert. Below the terrace was the private jetty and small, beautifully equipped yacht basin. Her visitors would have moored their craft there, the bare masts nodding lazily against the sky and the small Mediterranean blue wavelets lapping the stone jetty. Nicholas could hear the laughter and the tinkle of glasses in the background, and he cut short the recital of the guest list. "Is Duncan there?" "No, he's still in London. He won't be out until next week." "I have news. Can you get up to Paris?" "It's impossible, Nicky." Strange how the pet name did not jar from her. "I must be at Monte Carlo tomorrow. I'm helping Grace with the spring charity." "It's important, Chantal." "Then there's Peter. I don't like to leave him. Can't you come here? There's a direct flight at 9 tomorrow. I'll get rid of the house guests so we can talk in private." He thought quickly then, "All right, will you book me a suite at the Negresco?" "Don't be silly, Nicky. We've 13 perfectly good bedrooms here. We are both civilized people, and Peter would love to see you. You know that." The Côte d'Azur was reveling in a freakish burst of early spring weather when Nicholas came down the boarding ladder at Nice Airport. And Peter was waiting for him at the boundary fence, hopping up and down and waving both hands above his head like a semaphore signaller. But when Nicholas came through the gate, he regained his composure and shook hands formally. "It's jolly good to see you, Dad." "I swear you've grown 6 inches," said Nicholas, and on impulse stooped and hugged the child. For a moment they clung to each other, and it was Peter who pulled away first. Both of them were embarrassed by that display of affection for a moment. Then quite deliberately, Nicholas put his hand on Peter's shoulder and squeezed. "Where's the car?" He kept his hand on the child's shoulder as they crossed the airport foyer, and as Peter became more accustomed to this unusual gesture of affection, so he pressed closer to his father and seemed to swell with pride. Characteristically, Nicholas wondered what had changed about him that made it easier for him to act naturally towards those he loved. The answer was obvious. It was Samantha Silver who had taught him to let go. "Let go, Nicholas." He could almost hear her voice now. The chauffeur was new, a silent, unobtrusive man, and there were only the two of them in the back seat of the Rolls on the drive back through Nice, and along the coast road. "Mother has gone across to the palace. She won't be back until dinner time."
"Yes, she told me. We've got the day to ourselves." Nicholas grinned as the chauffeur turned in through the electric gates and white columns that guarded the entrance to the estate. "What are we going to do?"
They swam, and they played tennis, and took Peter's Arrowhead-class yacht Apache on a long reach up the coast as far as Menton, and then raced back, gull-winged and spinnaker set on the wind, with the spray kicking up over the bows and flicking into their faces. They laughed a lot, and they talked even more, and while Nicholas changed for dinner, he found himself caught up in the almost post-coital melancholy of too much happiness. Happiness that was transitory and soon must end. He tried to push the sadness aside, but it persisted as he dressed in a white silk roll neck and double-breasted blazer and went down to the terrace room. Peter was there before him, early as a child on Christmas morning, his hair still wet and slicked down from the shower, and his face glowing pinkly from the sun and happiness. "Can I pour you a drink, Dad?" he asked eagerly, already hovering over the silver drink tray. "Leave a little in the bottle," Nicholas cautioned him, not wanting to deny him the pleasure of performing this grown-up service. But with a healthy respect for the elephantine tots that Peter dispensed in a sense of misplaced generosity. He tasted the drink cautiously, gasped, and added more soda. "That's fine," he said. Peter looked proud. At that moment, Chantel came down the wide staircase into the room. Nicholas found it impossible not to stare. Was it possible she had grown more lovely since their last meeting? Or had she merely taken special pains this evening? She was dressed in ivory silk, woven gossamer fine, so it floated about her body as she moved. And as she crossed the last ruddy glow of the dying day that came in from the French windows of the terrace, the light struck through the sheer material and put the dainty line of her legs in a momentary silhouette. Closer to him, he saw the silk was embroidered with the same thread, ivory on ivory. A marvellous understatement of elegance. And under it, the shadowy outline of her breasts, those fine, shapely breasts that he remembered so well, and the faint, dusky rose suggestion of her nipples. He looked away quickly, and she smiled. "Nicky," she said, "I'm so sorry to have left you alone." "Peter and I had a high old time," he said. She had emphasized the shape and size of her eyes, and the planes of the bone structure of her cheeks and jawline, with a subtlety that made it appear she wore no makeup, and her hair had a springing electrical fire to it, a rich glowing sable cloud about the small head. The honeyed ivory of her skin had tanned to the velvety texture of a cream-coloured rose petal across her bare shoulders and arms. He had forgotten how relaxed and gracious she could be, and this magnificent building, filled with its treasures, standing in its pine forest, high above the darkening ocean, and the fairy lights of the coast, was her natural setting. She filled the huge room with a special glow and gaiety, and she and Peter shared an impish sense of fun that had them all laughing at the old, well-remembered jokes. Nicholas could not sustain his resentment, could not bring himself to dwell on her betrayal in this environment. So the laughter was easy and the warmth uncontrived. When they went through to the small, informal dining room, they sat at the table as they had done so often before. They seemed to be transported back in time to those happy, almost forgotten years. There were moments which might have jarred, but Chantel's instinct was so certain that she could skirt delicately around these. She She treated Nicholas as an honored guest, not as the master of the house. Instead, she made Peter the host. "Peter, darling, will you carve for us?" And the boy's pride and importance was almost overwhelming. Although the bird looked as though it had been caught in a combine harvester by the time he had finished with it. Chantelle served food and wine, a chicken stuffed in Creole style, and a petit chablis that had no special associations from the past. And the choice of music was Peter's. "Music to develop ulcers by," as Nicholas remarked aside to Chantelle. Peter fought a valiant rearguard action to delay the passage of time, but finally resigned himself when Nicholas told him, "I'll come and see you up to bed." He waited while Peter cleaned his teeth with an impressive vigour that might have continued beyond midnight if Nicholas had not protested mildly. When at last he was installed between the sheets, Nicholas stooped over him, and the boy wrapped both arms around his neck with a quiet desperation. "I'm so happy," he whispered against Nicholas's cheek. And when they kissed, he crushed Nicholas's lips painfully with his mouth. "Then, wouldn't it be fabulous if we could be like this always?" he asked. "If you didn't have to go away again, Dad." Chantelle had changed the wild music to the muted, haunting melodies of Liszt. And as he came back into the room, she was pouring cognac into a thin crystal balloon. "Did he settle down?" she asked, and then answered herself immediately. "He's exhausted, although he doesn't know it." She brought him the cognac, and they turned away and went out through the doors onto the terrace. He followed her out, and they stood at the stone balustrade side by side. The air was clear, but chill. "It's beautiful," she said. The moon paved a wide silver path across the surface of the sea. "I always thought that the highway to my dreams." "Duncan," he said, "let's talk about Duncan Alexander." And she shivered slightly, folding her arms across her breasts and grasping her own naked shoulders. "What do you want to know?" "In what terms did you give him control of your shares?" "As an agent, my personal agent." "With full discretion?" She nodded, and he asked next, "Did you have an escape clause? In what circumstances can you reclaim control?" "The dissolution of marriage," she said, and then shook her head. "But I think I knew that no court would uphold the agreement if I wanted to change it. It's too Victorian. Any time I want to, I could simply apply to have the appointment of Duncan as my agent set aside." "Yes, I think you're right," Nicholas agreed. "But it might take a year or more, unless you could prove he deliberately betrayed the trust of agency." "Can you prove that, Nicky?" She turned to him now, lifting her face to him. "Has he betrayed that trust?" "I don't know yet," Nicholas told her cautiously, and she cut in. "I made a terrible fool of myself, haven't I?" He kept silent, and she went on tremulously, "I know there's no way I can apologize to you for what I did. There's no way that I can make it up to you. But believe me, Nicholas, please believe me when I tell you I have never regretted anything so much in all my life." "It's past, Chantelle. It's over. There's no profit in looking back. I don't think there's another man in the world who would do what you're doing now, who would repay deceit and betrayal with help and comfort. I just wanted to say that." She was standing very close to him now, and in the cool night he could feel the warmth of her flesh across the inches that separated them, and her perfume had a subtlety-altered fragrance on the creamy skin. She always wore perfume so well, the same way she wore her clothes. "It's getting cold," he said brusquely, took her elbow, and steered her back into the light, out of that dangerous intimacy. "We still have a great deal to discuss." He paced the thick forest green carpet, quickly establishing a beat as regular as that of a sentry, 10 paces from the class doors, passing in front of where she sat in the centre of the wide velvet couch. Turning, just before he reached the headless marble statue of a Greek athlete from antiquity that guarded the double oaken doors into the lobby, and then back in front of her again. As he paced, he told her, in carefully prepared sequence, all that he'd learned from Lazarus. She sat like a bird on the point of flight, turning her head to watch him, those huge dark eyes seeming to swell larger as she listened. It was not necessary to explain it to her in layman's language. She was Arthur Christie's daughter. She understood when he told her how he suspected that Duncan Alexander had been forced to self-insure the hull of Golden Dawn, and how he had used Christie's stock to buy reinsurance, stock that he had probably already pledged to finance construction of the vessel. Nicholas reconstructed the whole inverted pyramid of Duncan Alexander's machinations for her to examine. And almost immediately, she saw how vulnerable, how unstable it was. "Are you certain of all this?" she whispered, and her face was drained of all its lustrous rose tints. He shook his head. "I've reconstructed the Tyrannosaurus from a jawbone," he admitted frankly. "The shape of it might be a little different, but one thing I am certain of is that it's a big and dangerous beast." "Duncan could destroy Christie Marine," she whispered again. "Completely." She looked around slowly at the house, at the room and its treasures, the symbols of her life. "He has risked everything that is mine and Peter's." Nicholas did not reply, but he stopped in front of her and watched her carefully as she absorbed the enormity of it all. He saw outrage turn slowly to confusion, to fear, and finally to terror. He'd never seen her even afraid before, but now, faced with the prospect of being stripped naked of the armor which had always protected her, she was like a lost animal. He could even see that flutter of her heart under the pale, swelling flesh of her bosom, and she shivered again. Could he lose everything, Nicholas? He couldn't, could he? She wanted assurance, but he could not give it to her. All he could give her was pity. Pity was the one emotion, probably the only one, she had never aroused in him, not once in all the years he had known her. "What can I do, Nicholas?" she pleaded. "Please help me. Oh, God, what must I do?" "You can stop Duncan launching Golden Dawn until the hull and propulsion has been modified, and it has been properly surveyed and underwritten, and until you have taken full control of Christie Marine out of his hands again." His voice was gentle, filled with his compassion as he told her. "That's enough for one day, Chantel. If we go on now, we begin tracing our tails. Tonight, you know what could happen. Tomorrow, we will discuss how we can prevent it. Have you a Valium?" She shook her head. "I've never used drugs to hide from things." It was true, he knew, that she had never lacked courage. "How much longer can you stay?" "I have a seat on the 11 o'clock plane. I have to be back in London by tomorrow night. We'll have time tomorrow morning." The guest suite opened onto the second floor balcony, which ran along the entire front of the building, overlooking the sea and the private harbour. The five main bedrooms all opened onto this balcony, an arrangement from 50 years previously, when internal security against kidnapping and forcible entry had been so important. Nicholas determined to speak to Chantelle about that in the morning. Peter was an obvious target for extortion, and he felt the goose bumps of horror rise on his arms as he imagined his son in the hands of those degenerate monsters who were everywhere allowed to strike and destroy with impunity. There was a price to pay these days for being rich and successful. The smell of it attracted the hyenas and vultures. Peter must be better protected, he decided. In the sitting room, there was a well-stocked liquor cabinet concealed behind mirrors. Nothing so obvious and resoundingly middle-class as a private bar. The daily papers, in English, French, and German, were set out on the television table. François, The Times, Allgemeine Zeitung, with even an airmail version of the New York Times. Nicholas flipped open The Times and glanced quickly at the closing prices. Christie Marine Common Stock was at £5.32, up 15p on yesterday's prices. The market had not sniffed corruption yet. He pulled off his silk roll neck, and even though he had bathed 3 hours previously, the tension had left his skin feeling itchy and unclean. The bathroom had been lavishly redecorated in green onyx panels, and the fittings were 18-carat gold in the shape of dolphins. Steaming water gushed from their gaping mouths a touch. It could have been vulgar, but Chantelle's unerring touch steered it into Persian opulence instead. He showered, turning the setting high so that the stinging needles of water scalded away his fatigue and the feeling of being unclean. There were half a dozen thick, white, terry-towelling robes in the glass-fronted warming cupboard, and he selected one and went through into the bedroom, belting it around his naked waist. In his briefcase, there was a draft of the agreement of sale of ocean salvage and towage to the sheikhs. James Teacher and his gang of bright young lawyers had read it and made a thick sheaf of notes. Nicholas must study these before tomorrow evening, when he met them in London. He took the papers from his case and carried them through into the sitting room, glancing at the top page before dropping them carelessly onto the low coffee table while he went to pour himself a small whiskey, heavily diluted. He brought the drink back with him and sprawled into the deep leather armchair, picked up the papers and began to work. He became aware of her perfume first, and felt his blood quicken uncontrollably at the fragrance, and the papers rustled in his hand. Slowly, he lifted his head. She had come in utter silence on small, bare feet. She had removed all her jewelry, and had let down her hair, brushing it out onto her shoulders. It made her seem younger, more vulnerable, and the gown she wore was cuffed and collared in fine, soft lace. She moved slowly towards his chair, timorous and for once uncertain, the eyes huge and dark and haunted. And when he rose from the armchair, she stopped, and one hand went to her throat. "Nicholas," she whispered, "I'm so afraid. And so alone." She moved a step closer and saw his eyes shift, his lips harden, and she stopped instantly. "Please," she pleaded softly, "don't send me away, Nicky.
Not tonight. Not yet. I'm afraid to be alone. Please. He knew then that this had been going to happen. He had hidden the certainty of it from himself all that evening. But now it was upon him, and he could do nothing to avoid it. It was as though he had lost the will to resist, as though he stood mesmerized, his resolve softening and melting like wax in the candle flame of her beauty, of the passions which she commanded so skillfully, and his thoughts lost coherence, began to tumble and swirl like storm surf breaking on rock. She recognized the exact instant when it happened to him, and she came forward silently, with small, gliding footsteps, not making the mistake of speaking again, and pressed her face to his bare chest, framed in the collar of his robe. The thick, curling hair was springing over hard, flat muscle, and she flared her nostrils at the clean, virile animal smell of his skin. He was still resisting, standing stiffly with his hands hanging at his sides. Oh, she knew him so well. The terrible conflict he must suffer before he could be made to act against that iron code of his own. Oh, she knew him. Knew that he was as sexual and physical an animal as she was herself. That he was the only man who had ever been able to match her appetites. She knew the defenses he had erected about himself, the fortressing of his passions, the controls and repressions. But she knew so well how to subvert these elaborate defenses. She knew exactly what to do and what to say, how to move and touch. And she began now. She found the deliberate act of breaking down his resistance excited her so swiftly that it was pain almost, agony almost, and it required all her own control not to advance too swiftly for him, to control the shaking of her legs and the pumping of her lungs, to play still the hurt and bewildered and frightened child, using his kindness, the sense of chivalry which would not allow him to send her away in such obvious distress. Oh God, how her body burned, her stomach cramped with the strength of her wanting, her breasts felt swollen and so sensitive that the contact of silk and lace was almost too painfully abrasive to bear. Oh, Nicky, please, just for a moment. Just once, hold me. Please, I cannot go on alone. Just for a moment. Please. She felt him lift his hands, felt the fingers on her shoulders, and the terrible pain of wanting was too much to bear. She could not control it. She cried out. It was a soft little whimper. The force of it shook her body, and immediately she felt his reaction. Her timing had been immaculate. Her natural womanly cunning had guided her. His fingers on her shoulders had been gentle and kindly, but now they hooked cruelly into her flesh. His back arched involuntarily. His breath drummed from his chest under her ear. A single agonized exhalation, like that of a boxer taking a heavy body punch. She felt his every muscle come taut, and she knew again the frightening power, the delirious, giddy power she could still wield. Then at last, joyously, almost fearfully, she experienced the great lordly lift and thrust of his loins, as though the whole world had moved and shifted about her. She cried out again, fiercely, for now she could slip the hounds that she'd held so short upon the leash, she could let them run and hunt again. They had been too long denied, but now there was no longer need for care and restraint. She knew exactly how to hunt him beyond the frontiers of reason, to course him like a flying stag. And his fingers tangled frantically in the foaming lace at her throat as he tried to free her tight, swollen breasts. She cried out a third time, and with a single movement jerked open the fastening at his waist, exposing the full, hard, lean length of his body, and her hands were as frantic as his. "Oh, sweet God, you're so hard and strong. Oh, sweet God, I've missed you too." There was time later for all the refinements and nuances of love. But now her need was too cruel and demanding to be denied another moment. It had to happen this instant before she died of the lack. Nicholas rose slowly towards the surface of sleep, aware of a brooding sense of regret. Just before he reached consciousness, a dream image formed in his sleep-starved brain. He relived a moment from the distant past. A fragment of time, recaptured so vividly as to seem whole and perfect. Long ago, he had picked up a deep-sea trumpet shell at 5 fathoms from the oceanic wall of the coral reef beyond the Anse Baudouin Lagoon of Praslin Island. It was the size of a ripe coconut, and once again he found himself holding the shell in both cupped hands, gazing into the narrow oval opening, around which the weed-furred and barnacle-encrusted exterior changed dramatically, flaring into the pouting lips and exposing the inner mother-of-pearl surfaces that were slippery to the touch, a glossy satin sheen, pale, translucent pink, folded and convoluted upon themselves, shading darker into fleshy crimsons and wine purples as the passage narrowed and sank away into the mysterious, lustrous depths of the shell. Then, abruptly, the dream image changed in his mind. The protected opening of the trumpet shell expanded, articulating on jaw hinges, and he was gaping into the deep and terrible maw of some great predatory sea creature, lined with multiple rows of serrated triangular teeth. Shark-like. Terrifying. So he cried out in his half-sleep, startling himself awake, and he rolled quickly onto his side and raised himself on one elbow. Her perfume still lingered on his skin, mingled with the smell of his own sweat. But the bed beside him was empty, though warm and redolent with the memory of her body. Across the room, the early sun struck a long silver of light through a narrow chink in the curtains. It looked like a blade, a golden blade. It reminded him instantly of Samantha Silver. He saw her again, wearing sunlight like a cloak, barefoot in the sand, and it seemed that the blade of sunlight was being driven up slowly under his ribs. He swung his feet off the wide bed and padded softly across to that gold and onyx bathroom. There was a dull ache of sleeplessness and remorse behind his eyes, and as he ran hot water from the dolphin's mouth into the basin, he looked at himself in the mirror, although the steam slowly clouded the image of his own face. There were dark smears below his eyes, and his features were gaunt, harsh angles of bone beneath drawn skin. "You bastard," he whispered at the shadowy face in the mirror. "You bloody bastard." They were waiting breakfast for him in the sunlight on the terrace under the gaily coloured umbrellas. Peter had preserved the mood of the previous evening, and he ran out laughing to meet Nicholas. "Dad, hey, Dad!"
He seized Nicholas's hand and led him to the table. Chantelle wore a long, loose house gown, and her hair was down on her shoulders, so soft that it stirred like spun silk in even that whisper of breeze. It was calculated. Chantelle did nothing by chance. The intimately elegant attire and the loose fall of her hair set the mood of domesticity, and Nicholas found himself resisting it fiercely. Peter sensed his father's change in mood with an intuitive understanding beyond his years, and his dismay was a palpable thing. The hurt and reproach in his eyes as he looked at Nicholas. And then the chatter dried on his lips, and he bent his head studiously over his plate and ate in silence. Nicholas deliberately refused the festival array of food, took only a cup of coffee and lit a cheroot, without asking Chantelle's permission, knowing how she would resent that. He waited in silence, and as soon as Peter had eaten, he said, "I'd like to speak to your mother, Peter." The boy stood obediently. "Will I see you before you leave, sir?" "Yes." Nicholas felt his heart wrung again. "Of course." "We could sail again?" "I'm sorry, my boy. We won't have time. Not today." "Very well, sir." Peter walked to the end of the terrace, very erect and dignified. Then suddenly he began to run, taking the steps down two at a time, and he fled into the pine forest beyond the boathouse as though pursued, feet flying and arms pumping wildly. "He needs you, Nicky," said Chantelle softly. "You should have thought about that 2 years ago." She poured fresh coffee into his cup. "Both of us have been stupid. All right, worse than that. We've been wicked. I've had my Duncan, and you have had that American child." "Don't make me angry now," he warned her softly. "You've done enough for one day." "It's as simple as this, Nicholas. I love you. I've always loved you. God, since I was a gawky schoolgirl." She'd never been that, but Nicholas let it pass. "Since I saw you that first day on the bridge of old Golden Eagle, the dashing ship's captain." "Chantelle, all we have to discuss is Golden Dawn and Christy Marine." "No, Nicholas. We were born for each other. Daddy saw that immediately. We both knew it at the same time. It was only a madness, a crazy whim that made me doubt it for a moment." "Stop it, Chantelle. Duncan was a stupid mistake, but it's unimportant." "No, it's not unimportant. It changed everything. It can never be the same again. Besides..."
"Besides what?"
"Nicky, what were you going to say?"
"Besides, I'm building myself another life now, with another very different person."
"Oh, God, Nicky, you aren't serious." She laughed then, genuine amusement, clapping her hands delightedly. "My dear, she's young enough to be your daughter. It's the 40 syndrome, the Lolita complex." Then she saw his real anger, and she was quick, retrieving the situation neatly, aware that she had carried it too far. "I'm sorry, Nicky. I should never have said that." She paused and then went on, "I will say she's a pretty little thing, and I'm sure she's sweet. Peter liked her." She damned Samantha with light condescension, and then dismissed her as though she were merely a childlike prank of Nicholas's, a light and passing folly of no real significance. "I understand, Nicholas, I truly do. However, when you're ready, as you will be soon, then Peter and I and Christy Marine are waiting for you still. This is your world, Nicholas." She made a gesture which embraced it all.
this is your world. You will never really leave it. You are wrong, Chantelle. No. She shook her head. I am very seldom wrong. And on this, I cannot be wrong. Last night proved that. It's still there, every bit of it. But let's discuss the other thing now. Golden Dawn and Christy Marine. Chantelle Alexander lifted her face to the sky and watched the big silver bird fly. It climbed, nose high, glinting in sunlight, twin trails of dark, unconsumed fuel spinning out behind it as the engines howled under full thrust. With the wind in this quarter, the extended center line of the main Nice runway brought it out over Cap Ferrat. Beside Chantelle, only an inch or two shorter than she was, Peter stood and watched it also, and she took his arm, tucking her small, dainty hand into the crook of his elbow. "He stayed such a short time," Peter said, and overhead the big Airbus turned steeply onto its crosswind leg. "We'll have him with us again soon," Chantelle promised. Then she went on, "Where were you, Peter? We hunted all over when it was time for Daddy to go." "I was in the forest," he said evasively. He had heard them calling, but Peter had hidden in the secret place, the smuggler's cleft in the yellow rock of the cliff. He would have killed himself rather than let Nicholas Berg see him weeping. "Wouldn't it be lovely if it was like the old times again?" Chantelle asked softly, and the boys stirred beside her, but unable to take his gaze from the aircraft. "Just the three of us again." "Without Uncle Duncan?" he asked incredulously. And high above them, the aircraft, the last twinkle of sunlight, dove deeply into the banks of cumulus cloud that buttressed the northern sky. Peter turned at last to face her. "Without Uncle Duncan?" he demanded again. "But that's impossible." "Not if you help me, darling." She took his face in her cupped hands. "You will help me, won't you?" she asked. And he nodded once, a sharply incisive gesture of assent. She leaned forward and kissed him tenderly on the forehead. "That's my man," she whispered. "Mr. Alexander is not available. May I take a message?" "This is Mrs. Alexander. Tell my husband that it's urgent." "Oh, I am terribly sorry, Mrs. Alexander." The secretary's voice changed instantly, cool caution becoming effusive civility. "I didn't recognize your voice. The line is dreadful. Mr. Alexander will speak to you directly." Chantelle waited, staring impatiently from the study windows. The weather had changed in the middle of the morning, with the cold front sweeping down off the mountains, and now icy wind and rain battered at the windows. "Chantelle, my dear," the rich, glossy voice that had once so dazzled her, "is this my call to you?" "It's mine, Duncan. I must speak to you urgently." "Good," he agreed with her. "I wanted to speak to you also. Things are happening swiftly here. It's necessary for you to come up to Saint-Nazaire next Tuesday instead of my joining you at Cap Ferrat." "Duncan." But he went on over her protest, his voice as full of self-confidence, as ebullient as she had not heard it in over a year. "I have been able to save almost 4 weeks on Golden Dawn." "Duncan, listen to me. We'll be able to launch on Tuesday. It'll be a makeshift ceremony, I'm afraid, at such short notice." He was inordinately proud of his own achievement. It annoyed her to hear him. "What I've arranged is that the pod tanks will be delivered direct to the Gulf from the Japanese yards. They're towing them in their ballast with four American tugs. I will launch the hull here with workmen still aboard her, and they will finish her off at sea during the passage around Good Hope, in time for her to take on her tanks and cargo at El Barras. We'll save nearly 7.5 million. Duncan. Chantel tried again, and this time something in her tone stopped him. What is it? This can't wait until Tuesday. I want to see you right away. That's impossible. He laughed lightly, confidently. It's only 5 days. 5 days is too long. Tell me now, he invited. What is it? All right, she said deliberately, and the vicious streak of Persian cruelty was in her voice. I'll tell you. I want a divorce, Duncan, and I want control of my shares in Christie Marine again. There was a long, hissing, crackling silence on the line, and she waited, the way the cat waits for the first movement of the crippled mouse. This is very sudden. His voice had changed completely. It was bleak and flat, lacking any timbre of resonance. We both know it is not, she contradicted him. You have no grounds. There was a thin edge of fear now. Divorce isn't quite as easy as that, Chantel. How is this for grounds, Duncan, she asked, and there was a spiteful sting in her voice now. If you aren't here by noon tomorrow, then my auditors will be in Leadenhall Street, and there'll be an urgent order before the courts. She did not have to go on. He spoke across her, and there was a note of panic in his voice. She'd never heard it before. He said, You're right. We do have to talk right away. Then he was silent again, collecting himself, and his voice was once more calm and careful when he went on. I can charter a Falcon and be at Nice before midday. Will that do? I'll have the car to meet you, she said, and broke the connection with one finger. She held the bar down for a second, then lifted her finger. I want to place an international call, she said, in her fluent, rippling French, when the operator answered. I don't know the number, but it's person to person. Dr. Samantha Silver at the University of Miami. There's a delay of more than 2 hours, madame. J'attendrai, she said, and replaced the receiver. The Bank of the East is in Curzon Street, almost opposite the White Elephant Club. It has a narrow frontage of bronze and marble and glass, and Nicholas had been there with his lawyers since 10 o'clock that morning. He was learning at first hand the leisurely, age-old ritual of Oriental bargaining. He was selling ocean salvage, plus 2 years of his future labor. And even for $7 million, he was beginning to wonder if it was worth it. And it was not a certain $7 million either. The words tripped lightly. The figures seemed to have no substance in this setting. The only constant was the figure of the prince himself, seated on the low couch, in a several-row suit, but with the fine white cotton and gold-corded headdress framing his dark, handsome features with theatrical dash. Beyond him moved a shadowy, ever-changing background of unctuous, whispering figures. Every time that Nicholas believed that a point had been definitely agreed, another rose-pink or acid-yellow Rolls-Royce with Arabic script number plates would deposit 3 or 4 more dark-featured Arabs at the front doors. And they would hurry through to kiss the prince on his forehead, on the bridge of his nose, and on the back of his hand. And the hushed discussion would begin all over again, with the newcomers picking up at the point they had been an hour previously.
James Teacher showed no impatience, and he smiled and nodded and went through the ritual like an Arab born, sipping the little thimbles of treacly coffee and watching patiently for the interminable whisperings to be translated into English before making a measured counter-proposal. "We're doing fine, Mr. Berg," he assured Nicholas quietly. "A few more days." Nicholas had a headache from the strong coffee and the Turkish tobacco smoke, and he found it difficult to concentrate. He kept worrying about Samantha. For 4 days he had tried to contact her. He had to get out for a while, and he excused himself to the prince and went down to the inquiry's desk in the bank's entrance hall, and the girl told him, "I'm sorry, sir, there's no reply to either of those numbers." "There must be," Nicholas told her. "One number was Samantha's shack at Key Biscayne, and the other was her private number in her laboratory." She shook her head. "I've tried every hour." "Can you send a cable for me?"
"Of course, sir."
She gave him a pad of forms, and he wrote out the message. "Please phone me urgently. Reverse charge to..." He gave the number of the Queensgate flat and James Teacher's rooms. Then he thought, with the pen poised, trying to find the words to express his concern. But there were none. "I love you," he wrote. "I really do." Since Nicholas's midnight call to her of the carriage of Cadderidge crude petroleum, Samantha Silver had been caught up in a kaleidoscope whirl of time and events. After a series of meetings with the leaders of the Green Peacers and other conservation bodies in an effort to publicize and oppose this new threat to the oceans, she and Tom Parker had flown to Washington and met with the deputy director of the Environmental Protection Agency and with two young senators who spearheaded the conservation lobby. But their efforts to go further had been frustrated by the granite walls of big oil interest. Even usually cooperative sources had been wary of condemning or speaking out against Orient Amex's new carbon-cracking technology. As one 30-year-old Democrat senator had pointed out, "It's tough to try and take a shot at something that's going to increase the fossil fuel yield by 50%. "That's not what we're shooting at," Samantha had flared, bitter with fatigue and frustration. "It's this irresponsible method of carrying the Cadderidge through sensitive and highly vulnerable seaways we're trying to prevent." But when she presented the scenario she'd worked out, picturing the effects of the North Atlantic deluged with a million tons of toxic crude, she saw the disbelief in the man's eyes and the condescending smile of the sane for the slightly demented. Oh, God, why is common sense the hardest thing in the world to sell? She had lamented. She and Tom had gone on to meet the leaders of Greenpeace in the North and in the West, and they had given advice and promises of support. The Californian chapter counseled physical intervention as a last resort, as some of their members had successfully interposed small craft between the Russian whalers and the breeding minks that were hunting in the Californian Gulf. In Galveston, they met the young Texans who would picket the Orient Amex refinery as soon as they were certain the ultra-tanker had entered the Gulf of Mexico. However, none of their efforts were successful in provoking confrontation with Orient Amex. The big oil company simply ignored invitations to debate the charges on radio or television, and stonewalled questions from the media. It's hard to stir up interest in a one-sided argument, Samantha found. They managed one local Texas television show, but without controversy to give it zip. The
Producer cut Samantha's time down to 45 seconds and then tried to date her for dinner. The energy crisis, oil tankers and oil pollution were joyless subjects. Nobody had ever heard of cadmium pollution. The Cape of Good Hope was half a world away. 1 million tons was a meaningless figure, impossible to visualize. It was all rather a bore. The media let it drop flat on its face. We're just gonna have to smoke those fat cats at Orient Amex out into the open, Tom Parker growled angrily, and kick their asses blue for them. The only way we're gonna do that is through Greenpeace. They'd landed back at Miami International, exhausted and disappointed, but not yet despondent. Like the man said, Samantha muttered grimly, as she threaded her gaudy van back into the city traffic flow. We have only just begun to fight. She had only a few hours to clean herself up and stretch out on the patchwork quilt, before she had to dress again and race back to the airport. The Australian had already passed through customs and was looking lost and dejected in the terminal lobby. "Hi, I'm Sam Silver." She pushed away fatigue and hoisted that brilliant golden smile like a flag. His name was Dr. Dennis O'Connor, and he was top man in his field, doing fascinating and important work on the reef populations of eastern Australian waters. And he'd come a long way to talk to her and see her experiments. "I didn't expect you to be so young." She had signed her correspondence Dr. Silver, and he gave the standard reaction to her. Samantha was just tired and angry enough not to take it. "And I'm a woman. You didn't expect that either," she agreed. "It's a crying bastard, isn't it? But then, I bet some of your best friends are young females." He was a dinky-die Aussie, and he loved it. He burst into an appreciative grin, and as they shook hands, he said, "You're not going to believe this, but I like you just the way you are." He was tall and lean, sunburned, and dressed a little grizzled at the temples. And within minutes they were friends, and the respect with which he viewed her work confirmed that. The Australian had brought with him, in an oxygenated container, 5,000 live specimens of E. digitalis, the common Australian sea water snail, for inclusion in Samantha's experimentation. He had selected these animals for their abundance and their importance in the ecology of the Australian inshore waters. And the two of them were soon so absorbed in the application of Samantha's techniques to this new creature that when her assistant stuck her head through and yelled, "Hey, Sam, there's a call for you," she shouted back, "Take a message. If they're lucky, I'll call them back."